As many Texans struggle to make ends meet in a pandemic, politicians debate what sort of relief to offer. Our conversation with Senator John Cornyn today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. Among the biggest cities in the U.S., residents of Houston appear to be facing the toughest challenges when it comes to personal finance and health. Details from a new survey by NPR and Harvard. Also, the politics of medicine amid a pandemic, how college campuses are trying to curb the spread amid rising COVID numbers, the Fed changes its position on curbing inflation, and what that might mean for most everyday folks, plus a whole lot more. When the national news show of You Know Where gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this ninth day of September 2020. I'm David Brown. Thanks for joining us, and we hope your Wednesday's been a good one so far. The home of the Luann Platter, a Texas landmark of sorts since the post-war years, is soon to be no more. We'll have more on the demise of Luby's in about 25 minutes or so in the Texas Roundup. But as we look at some of our top stories, we loop back to yesterday's report on the first woman to head the Dallas police force in its history. Shortly after we broadcast our story on how Dallas Police Chief Renee Hall had been coming under fire for her handling of recent protests of police brutality in the wake of George Floyd's killing, Chief Hall resigned her post as the city's top cop. An investigation by the Dallas Morning News found that police used pepper ball launchers against peaceful protesters, and a federal judge temporarily restrained Dallas police from using other so-called less lethal weapons against demonstrators. None of that was mentioned in Hall's resignation letter, in which she cited other inquiries about future career opportunities, which she added would remain confidential for now. Hall has been Dallas police chief since 2017. She's been asked to stay on till the end of the year. John Cornyn has been in his current office since 2002, and many believe he's in the toughest race of his political career this year, facing Democratic challenger MJ Hager. Yesterday, when we spoke with him, he just returned to D.C. from Austin as lawmakers were taking up an issue critical to many Texans right now, relief to help weather the pandemic. Many lives and livelihoods have been put on hold by shutdowns and social distancing requirements, and initial assistance from the federal government has dried up in many quarters. Now the senior senator from Texas is among the Republicans trying to push through another aid package, one that many Democrats are not on board with, as it's considerably more modest than their own proposal. Senator John Cornyn of Texas, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Great to be with you.
Well, U.S. senators back from their summer recess this week, and we've been hearing about divisions between parties holding up the passing of another major coronavirus aid package. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was announcing that Republicans in the Senate, including yourself, will vote to advance an emergency stimulus plan. What does that plan include?
Well, this will include what I would call the bipartisan consensus items that were previously a part of the Republican offer, which was called the HEALS Act. As you know, that was about $1 trillion worth of additional spending. And the Speaker Pelosi and House Democrats had countered that with a $3 trillion additional spending bill called the HEROES Act. But that's on top of the $3 trillion we've already spent through four different pieces of legislation culminating in the CARES Act in late March. But I think there's still work that needs to be done.
Is your objection to the Democrats' plan that it's too expensive?
It is that it includes a lot of non-COVID-related issues. For example, it includes a tax cut for some of the wealthiest people in large blue states like New York and California. And it also includes a variety of different things to support the cannabis industry. And just it's really a grab bag of a lot of different unrelated things. What we need to do is recognize that we're in a two-front war. One is a public health battle, and the other is an economic recession caused by the mitigation efforts. And I think we need to focus on those things and leave these other issues for a later fight on another day.
You know, I think everyday Texans are concerned about how they're going to pay their next month's rent or their mortgage. What about that $600 a week unemployment benefit? Is that going to be reinstated in the Republican plan?
Well, pay out another direct payment to individuals through no fault of their own, as you point out, or out of work or working reduced hours. And then there will be a reinstatement of the unemployment insurance supplement. The exact amount is not the subject of an agreement, but under the president's executive order now, it's an additional $300 a week. There were some people receiving actually more money not working than to work, which is not obviously our intention to incentivize people to stay away from work if they can safely return, but merely to replace their lost wages. So that's something we still have to work out.
Well, now the August jobs report shows unemployment rate falling below 10% for the first time since the nation went on lockdown. But the Washington Post is reporting just over half of the 22 million total jobs lost between February and April have not returned. What does a Senate Republican measure do to address that consideration? Because that's a serious figure there.
Well, it is, and it's not going to change until we are able to navigate this virus and to get on with our lives safely. And we're seeing this playing out right now with kids going back to school, college students returning to college. But I think we've learned a lot of lessons. The vaccine is probably not going to be here until the latter part of the year or the beginning of next year. So what we all need to do is take personal responsibility, which is to wash your hands, wear masks, socially distance, and stay home when you're sick. And what we've seen is that actually has a pretty impressive impact in terms of bringing down the spreading of the virus. But that's going to be the formula until we can get that vaccine. I know Governor Abbott and others are looking at what else we can do to reopen to hopefully get people back to work and help grow our economy, because we can't sustain this situation forever where millions of Americans are out of work.
Let me ask you something, Senator. This administration as a whole, how do you think the overall response has been to the COVID crisis? And what are you telling Texans as you're campaigning, Texans who are out of a job or worried about their kids going back to school?
Well, this pandemic is something that nobody saw coming. And it's created an unprecedented experience. And it's been dramatic and it's been painful. And I really feel particularly for people who are out of work and not receiving any income. Because of the mitigation efforts. And that's why I voted for $3 trillion worth of emergency spending, something I would never do except under circumstances like this. But we didn't know how long this was going to last. We had hoped that we'd be in better shape than we are right now. We are starting to see some encouraging numbers coming from the efforts that we're all undertaking. As I said, each of us have a personal role we can play in slowing down and hopefully slowing down that spread. But I think, you know, there's always room for criticism and finger pointing. I don't really find that very constructive at this point. I think people have by and large done the best they could under very difficult and unprecedented circumstances.
Obviously, I mentioned you're running for reelection. Do you plan on campaigning with President Trump in the coming weeks?
I have not spent any time campaigning at all. I've been, virtually none. I am spending time traveling around the state, going to high schools and colleges and listening to the county judges and mayors and others tell me how what we have done, how that has met their need and where more needs to be done. The Save Our Stages Act is just one example of that, the work we're trying to do to help restaurants be available to reopen once the government officials allow it. That's been where my focus is. This is the strangest reelection that I've ever been through because it involves very little campaigning. It's basically doing the job I've already been elected to do.
Let me ask you one other thing, and I know you've been involved in politics long enough to remember back in the day when Republicans were really concerned about the budget deficit and about whether we'd ever be able to pay back what we owed. And I noticed just the other day that we crossed a new threshold that we haven't since World War II. We're now, our debt is now greater than our gross domestic product. That's historic. We ever going to be able to pay this back?
Well, we don't have any choice. It is very distressing, to be sure, but I view this as sort of a domestic equivalent to World War II when we were trying to defeat Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, which was an existential threat to our country and to the rest of the world. We didn't worry about deficits and debt, but you're absolutely right that this is not going away. This is not monopoly money, and the historic efforts that we've undertaken to try to keep the economy afloat and try to deal with the public health crisis has run up a huge tab. But now, after we get this under control, we need to turn on a bipartisan basis to addressing that debt and those deficits. No doubt about it.
You've been generous with your time, Senator. I just have one follow-up on that, because you are noting that we are in a time now similar to what we faced during the last World War. Given those exigencies, sir, you look at the Democrats' plan, they want to spend $2 trillion more than the Republicans do. Why not, if we're at a time of war?
Well, I don't want to spend money giving millionaires and billionaires a tax cut. They want to reverse what we put in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which capped the deductibility of state and local taxes. And as you know, some of these places like New York and San Francisco, they have much, much higher taxes than we have in Texas. So basically what happens is you have Texans subsidizing millionaires and billionaires in places like San Francisco and New York. I just don't think that's fair. And so I'm not willing to go there.
Republican U.S. Senator John Cornyn is running for re-election in November. Senator Cornyn, thanks again for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much.
Now, we've reached out to John Cornyn's Democratic challenger in the general election, M.J. Hager, and we hope to have her join us on the Texas Standard very soon. Rest assured, social media editor Wells Dunbar is monitoring what Texans are talking about on this Wednesday. Hi there, Wells.
Hi, David. Good to be with you. We're hearing
good to be
from
with
our
you.
Yeah, thanks. We're hearing from our friends and listeners out there. It's great to hear from them about our talk with Senator John Cornyn. And here's one response via Facebook from John E. Davis about the exorbitant government spending necessitated by the coronavirus pandemic. John writes, "If we can throw billions at corporations every time there's a ripple in the economic or GDP continuum, we can throw money at our citizens to keep the country alive," seemingly calling for another round of stimulus funding to the American populace there. You know, David, we are also continuing to hear from dozens and dozens of folks about how back to school season is going for their children, what with the Zooms and the internet meetings and whatnot. Tons of those comments. I will be back with lots of those responses and more from social media later in the program.
Yeah, how's it working out on the home front, Texas? We would love to hear from you. You know what to do. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. And as always, Wells Dunbar is looking for you. He'll be back with us in about 35 minutes or so as the Texas Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, sharing that regular screenings like mammograms and colonoscopies are essential preventative appointments. Early detection of cancer often leads to better outcomes. More at texasoncology.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. There's new data out this morning on the impact the pandemic is having, data that suggests that when it comes to personal finance and health, Houston is suffering the most compared to the nation's other three biggest cities. Houston Public Media's Sarah Willa Ernst has the first of two reports on what we can learn from this survey done by NPR and Harvard on health in Texas's most populous city.
My temperature this morning was 97. My oxygen was 96. This guy asked me for my blood sugar. Now, don't judge me, okay?
This morning. Every day, Veronica Barrientes logs her vitals into a telehealth app on her phone at her home in Southeast Houston. She started doing this in early August, after she was hospitalized at Memorial Hermann due to COVID-19. She's feeling better, but still recovering.
I still use a walker because I'm not 100% as far as strength goes, but I'm getting better every day.
At her worst, she laid on the couch for days, overwhelmed by the fatigue and coughing. As the days passed, she was just getting sicker. So she called for an ambulance. Barrientes did this three times, because each time, the EMT said to her,
"If we send you to the hospital, they're just going to send you home. You know, they're not going to do nothing. They don't have any treatment. I would just rest, take some Mucinex, drink a lot of fluids, water."
On the third call, she just couldn't take it anymore, and insisted to go to the hospital. Barrientes is one of many blocked from medical care since the beginning of the pandemic. Around 1 in 4 Houstonians surveyed said they got delayed care or were just unable to get medical care for a serious problem. This data on just how many Houstonians have been affected was uncovered by a research partnership between NPR and Harvard School of Public Health. They surveyed around 500 people in the 4 largest cities in the U.S., New York, L.A., Chicago, and Houston, in the month of July. In Texas, that was during the peak of new daily infections. Many of these healthcare delays were not for COVID-19 cases, but rather elective procedures. A statewide order in late June postponed some elective surgeries as coronavirus patients across the state were filling hospitals up. Barrientes spent 6 days at the hospital.
They did all the tests and they did a CAT scan of my lungs. They said that I had 2 blood clots and pneumonia that I should have been in a week ago.
Just like Barrientes, 75% of these respondents believe the delays had negative consequences on their health.
I absolutely believe if they would have taken me in, I would not have probably had the blood clots. You know, now I'm on blood thinners for 3 months because of that.
Now she's just trying not to think about the bill that's going to come. She knows this hospital is out of network for her insurance.
If I get a big bill from the hospital, it's going to be one of those. It's going to take me the rest of my life to pay.
Compared to other cities, the NPR survey found that Houston had twice as many people reporting serious problems affording medical care. Houston has the largest uninsured population in the country. That number has only grown this year as job losses cause many to lose insurance. One silver lining for Barrientes, though, her employer doesn't offer insurance, but has been understanding throughout the pandemic. She got paid time off when she was sick and when the office closed for 2 months. This steady paycheck has allowed her to just focus on getting better and to reflect on the experience.
My perspective in life has changed because now you realize how valuable your life is and the people around you. And you never really think about it until something like this happens.
She's happy to have some kind of normalcy back in her life, like having her grandkids over the house again after isolating with just her husband for so long.
And it sounds like they are here. Say hi, handsome boy.
Hi.
Say hi, Ezra.
I'm Sarah Willa Ernst in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. With the pandemic, politics, weather crises, and so much else going on in the world right now, you'd be forgiven for missing a bit of news about an important shift in Federal Reserve policy. Basically, when the U.S. economy is doing well, the Fed now says it will no longer try to cap inflation right at 2%. Inflation's the rising cost of things over time. For a better picture of what all this means and why it's so important, we turn now to Ray Perryman. He's president and CEO of the economic research firm The Perryman Group, which is based in Waco. Ray, good to talk with you again, sir.
My pleasure.
Put this into context for us. I know you've been paying attention to the Federal Reserve policy for a long time. Just how big of a deal is this change?
Well, it's a very big deal, and it sounds fairly simple on the surface. Basically, if you think about it, they're changing from a ceiling to an average. That doesn't sound like a big deal, but if you think about it, if you have a ceiling, that means your average is always going to be lower than that. So in essence, they're giving themselves a little bit more flexibility, which is a fairly significant policy shift for the Fed.
Let's roll back for just a moment so that people understand what the Fed has been doing over the last, for a long time. When the inflation rate would start to hit that 2% number, the Fed would what? They would try to bring down interest rates to make it cheaper for people to borrow money?
That's exactly right. And of course, that helps stimulate an economy. And what has been happening, or what we're afraid might happen after this pandemic, is inflation is very low right now. As we start a recovery, if prices begin to spike, by the old policy, the Fed would have started shutting things down and slowing the economy down long before we were back on a good, solid economic footing. This gives them the flexibility to go beyond this. Historical context, very briefly here, since the late 70s, early 80s, when inflation became enormously high up in the double-digit range, they really put the emphasis on the lower inflation, kind of let economic growth take care of itself to some extent. And what we're seeing is over time, because of globalization, think about a lot of prices fall a lot. Think about the price you paid for a certain size television 2 years ago and what you pay today. You know, a lot of prices are falling with new technology, global competition. A number of things have made prices have a little more stabilization capacity than they've had before. And so the Fed doesn't have to be so focused on inflation now, and they're giving themselves a little bit of wiggle room here to try to help us come out of this pandemic.
So are they sending us a message that they expect that the economy is going to be on a downward trajectory for some time, and so they're giving themselves a little bit more room?
Well, I don't think they're telling us it's going to be on a downward trajectory. In fact, it's already coming back some from the depths that we've seen. I think what they're telling us is, as we continue to grow, if we happen to hit a place where inflation goes up a little bit above 2%, they're not going to start shutting things down immediately. They're going to give the economy the time and flexibility that it needs to grow.
For the everyday Texan, what does this mean? I mean, some of us might be familiar with inflation because of annual raises, for example, that are often designed to offset those rising costs of living.
Well, what it tells us as the average person is, if you've had some instability in your job as a result of the pandemic or in your business or any other activity, that you're not going to get a situation where, because of an arbitrary rule, the Federal Reserve is going to start doing things to make it harder for you to get back on your feet. I mean, that's giving the Federal Reserve more flexibility to let inflation go up a little bit above the 2% range in order to allow the economy to continue to grow. May not even prove to be necessary. We've proven the last 10 years we can grow a lot without much inflation.
Well, like nature, economists abhor a vacuum. And so once you start to lift this 2% cap, right, how does that work going forward? Is 4% too much inflation? Is 5%? What about that double-digit inflation that people were having to live with? You remember those double-digit mortgage rates and stuff?
I remember them all too well. but yeah, and that's the trade-off you have to face. And you're going to have to rely on the Fed to manage that properly. And you have a lot of good, experienced people there. You know, my suspicion is they're going to start looking at things pretty carefully as it gets above 2%, just not immediately pull the trigger. But they're not going to let inflation spiral, because once we did that, we had to work our way out of it. And that was during the Volcker era at the Federal Reserve, when unemployment went up to 11 or 12%, not because of a pandemic, but because of our efforts to bring inflation down. No one wants to get in that situation again.
Ray Perryman is president and CEO of the economic research firm, the Perryman Group. Ray, thanks again.
My pleasure.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good, like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save the horned lizard from extinction. TCU, lead on.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A federal judge says how Texas verifies signatures on mail-in ballots is unconstitutional. Election officials can compare a voter's signature on their ballot envelope with the signature on their vote-by-mail application to determine if it's valid. U.S. District Judge Orlando Garcia ruled Tuesday ballots cannot be rejected due to a perceived signature mismatch without first giving voters a chance to address the issue. Texas practitioners in 10 healthcare-related fields must now participate in human trafficking prevention training in order to renew their licenses and permits. The state law, which took effect September 1st, applies to roughly 70,000 workers, including midwives, massage therapists, and athletic trainers. The requirement stems from a bipartisan bill Democratic State Representative Cesar Blanco of El Paso sponsored last year.
I think that this is a good first step in ensuring that our Texas healthcare professionals are both knowledgeable and adequately prepared in our state's fight against human trafficking.
Blanco says Texas has the second highest number of reported human trafficking victims in the nation. Other states, such as Massachusetts and Michigan, have similar training requirements. A new poll from the Dallas Morning News and the University of Texas at Tyler finds Democrats and Republicans in the state are deeply divided over removing Confederate monuments from public spaces. Communities across Texas and the U.S. have been taking down such markers in response to ongoing protests for racial justice. UT Tyler professor Mark Owen says while 69% of Democrats support removing Confederate monuments, 70% of Republicans are opposed. He says the numbers haven't changed much from when they asked the question in a July poll.
People have, I think, in some cases, made up their minds about where they are on this issue of whether the statues have a place in their community or do not.
The latest poll surveyed nearly 1,200 registered voters between August 28th and September 2nd. And the company behind the Texas restaurant staple Luby's and Fuddruckers is planning to liquidate its businesses. TPR's Brian Kirkpatrick has more on the announcement from Luby's Incorporated.
The company pegged its property and assets at around $104 million in June, but owed $57 million in long-term debt and nearly $23 million in lease obligations. Bob Luby opened the first Luby's in San Antonio in 1947. Chris and Harris Pappas took over the company in 2001 and moved its headquarters to Houston. I'm Brian Kirkpatrick in San Antonio.
And I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the University of Texas at Dallas, where nearly 30,000 students strive for academic rigor, career focus, and social opportunities. More at utdallas.edu/bright. UT Dallas, moving at the speed of bright.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Odds are that what you think about the drug hydroxychloroquine as a treatment for COVID-19 says a lot about your politics. The anti-malarial drug has received significant support from President Trump and other prominent conservatives, despite the National Institutes of Health cautioning against its use. But a poll by Politico and research company Morning Consult showed that while 71% of Republicans supported treating COVID-19 with hydroxychloroquine, only 29% of Democrats did. Support for other drugs falls along similar partisan lines, as do attitudes about mask wearing and social distancing. Clearly, partisanship has crept into our conversation about public health, but is this something truly new? Here to talk about that is Susan Gimo. She's a public health expert and professor of political science at Marquette University. Professor Gimo, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Why is this happening? Why is the efficacy of certain treatments, why has it turned into a partisan issue?
I think it's because the president has pretty much continuously questioned the science and questioned his own task force on COVID-19. And so I think he has, in large part, made it a partisan political issue. And I think he's fed into existing polarization in the electorate and has really made this pandemic a political partisan issue.
I wonder how much of this is actually linked to an erosion of confidence in other institutions, not just the presidency. Food and Drug Administration, for example, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, that sort of thing.
There may be some of that, too, because and I think a lot has to do, too, with President Trump is and others who question some of the efficacy of the recommendations coming out of these institutions are tapping into a strong anti-science, anti-vaccination movement that predates this particular pandemic. So there was already, I think, a wealth of suspicion toward government institutions around things like vaccines. And I think the administration's flip-flopping or undermining of some of these organizations like the CDC reduces and erodes public trust in these institutions and what they're saying.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned science and questioning science. I guess in some ways, this might not necessarily be that new a phenomenon on one level. I mean, we saw the politicization of global climate change, for example, global warming. How long have we been experiencing this? And are we noticing more, perhaps, because of the circumstances? Or how do you see it?
Well, I think it's been around. I think the questioning of science has been around. And as I referred to already, the anti-vax movement. But I think climate change fits into that as well. I think what's different is that the president of the United States questions the science. And so that makes it gives it a voice, if you will. And it's not just fringe groups or people on the conspiracy theorists or people like that who are questioning it. But now it is given some legitimate weight because the president of the United States has said that. And now it's just carried over into the COVID-19 pandemic.
There seem to be clear dangers, though, when we're talking about politicizing medicine, especially in a pandemic. And one of the dangers is that if it is seen as a political argument and not an argument about best practices or what we have to do facing an imminent threat. I guess the question that I have for you, is this something that a society can collectively stop doing? You know, put the brakes on the politicization of medicine once that spiral gets going?
Well, I think there will be people who will continue to question the science. And part of the issue, too, is that the science keeps changing. This is a new virus. Some of the recommendations from the CDC and WHO have changed as the science has changed. Some of these organizations have come under political pressure, though, to change their recommendations. So it is very hard to stop this once it's in play. But I think the alternative to not believe the science is to allow the death toll to keep going up and the cases to keep exploding. And I think maybe eventually people will say enough is enough.
Professor, what does all this mean for, say, the next shoe that will drop, the rollout of a large-scale vaccine, for example, further down the road?
Well, there's a lot of hope that a vaccine will come online soon. There are a lot of different companies doing these clinical trials. But at the same time, I think there's some fear that it might be politicized and the timetable might be sped up for political purposes in time for the election. So I think that could worry some people. And we don't know what the long-term effects will be. I saw a poll where I think they said 3/4 of the respondents said they would take the vaccine if it was available. But if there are bad side effects that come out, then that might undermine public trust in it.
Susan Jaimo is a public health expert and a professor of political science at Marquette University. Professor, thanks for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, a tax advantage savings program helping eligible Texans with disabilities save for the future. Learn more, including how the program works with certain public benefits, at texasable.org.
It's a Texas Standard. Most Texas students returned to school yesterday with no small amount of trepidation among parents, teachers, and administrators. Case in point, Bexar County. Texas Public Radio's Camille Phillips has been looking into the decision made by district leaders there and how parents are feeling about it.
With 4 children between the ages of 2 and 15, distance learning is pretty chaotic at Tracy Sinha's house.
I have 1 high school student, 1 middle school student, and 1 elementary school student, which even with neurotypical kids would be difficult because all the schedules are all different.
At lunchtime on Friday, her 15-year-old had a Zoom chemistry lesson. Her 8 and 13-year-old watched Angry Bird cartoons on their lunch break while waiting for their frozen pizza to bake in the oven.
Yeah, pizza's done. Thank you, Meadow.
Sinha originally decided to keep all of her children in virtual learning for at least the first 9 weeks of school. But she says distance learning is not working for her 8-year-old son, Finnegan, who is autistic and language delayed.
We have spent most of his life trying to help him find his voice. And whenever he's getting on these Zoom calls and trying to connect with his teachers, he's missing a core element of his communication, which is nonverbal, which is, you know, body language.
So when Finnegan's teacher told her Northside is starting out with just English learners and special education students in self-contained settings, she changed her mind.
This was a very, I'd say, one of the most agonizing decisions I made because I did pick virtual. I look at my middle schooler and my high schooler, and yes, they would prefer to be in person, but there isn't a need the way there is with my 8-year-old. He needs it.
San Antonio's 5 largest districts, including Northside, are phasing in face-to-face instruction. Most are starting with 5 or 6 students per class this week, as recommended by San Antonio Metro Health, along with masks and social distancing. But Alamo Heights, East Central, Somerset, and a few charter networks are bringing in more students than Metro Health currently says is safe. Alamo Heights Superintendent Dana Becerra says many of her parents want their children back in the classroom.
This is not a mandate, it's a recommendation, and I've been carefully watching the metrics and feel like by the time, you know, we're ready to bring the 65 to 67% back that want to be back, we should be in a good place.
Alamo Heights is giving each grade 2 or 3 days with half full classrooms to learn safety protocols, but we'll have full classes in some grades by September 14th. Almost half of East Central's 10,000 students requested in-person instruction. East Central is bringing them back on alternating days instead of phasing them in. Mariana Anderson says her 9-year-old daughter, Aslan, will likely have 11 or 12 classmates at Founders Classical Academy in shirts. But for her, the potential risk is worth it.
She was just getting really terrible grades, and we have to keep submitting it. And I just realized this is not how she learns. She does better in front of a teacher.
Anderson is back at her job teaching art in the Judson School District, and her husband is juggling working from home and helping Aslan.
We just had to make the tough decision that we don't necessarily have a choice. Not that many people do, but this is just, we thought this was the best for what we had to do, what were we given.
She says she's not that worried about the coronavirus, though, because she and her daughter and husband have good immune systems.
But then we do have, you know, family members that I would worry about. My father-in-law already said once she starts going to school, he's not comfortable us coming around, which we understand. He's older and he does have some diabetes and health-related issues like that.
Anderson says she hopes her daughter will start loving school again once she's back in the classroom. But she's a bit worried about how Aslan will adjust to wearing a mask all day. I'm Camille Phillips in San Antonio.
Dora Hand, many said, was the most beautiful woman in Dodge City back in the 70s. That would be the 1870s. As commentator W.F. Strong tells us, her murder sent one well-heeled Texas rancher to come to the aid of the accused, his cowboy son.
To her rare beauty, you may add an angelic hypnotic voice that mesmerized all the cowboys who saw her perform at the Lady Gay Theater. She was a nightly singer there and performed also at the Alhambra Saloon. The cowboys coming in off the range from long cattle drives flocked to hear her. Dora was much loved in the city for her singing and also because she shared her substantial income quite liberally with the less fortunate of Dodge. Dodge City Mayor Jim Dog Kelly also owned the Alhambra and as such was Hand's benefactor and protector and probable boyfriend. One cowboy from Texas, the wealthy and handsome James Spike Kennedy, came to hear her sing and was soon infatuated with her. Dog and Spike eventually got into a barroom brawl over their dislike for one another, and Mayor Kelly spiked Spike, headfirst, embarrassingly, into the dirt street outside. Spike Kennedy could not let this slight go unanswered. He left town a while and bought himself the fastest horse he could find. Then he returned one night to the mayor's house and fired 2 shots through the plank wood at the spot where he knew Dog slept. Unbeknownst to him, Mayor Kelly was not home. Dora was house-sitting. Spike had killed her. Famed Dodge City Sheriff Bat Masterson assembled a posse of lawmen, including Wyatt Earp, Bill Tillman, and Charlie Bassett. Together, they took off after Spike Kennedy. It was kind of a dream team posse, as if Superman, Batman, and Spider-Man and Captain America got together to bring Spike to justice. They took a shortcut and caught up with Spike as he was ready to cross the Arkansas River. He turned his horse and ran, but Wyatt Earp shot Spike's horse out from under him. Masterson winged Spike in the shoulder. They took him back to Dodge and put him in jail, where Spike learned he had killed Dora instead of Kelly, though he didn't confess to the crime. Spike's father, Texas rancher Mifflin Kennedy, immediately made his way to Dodge City to arrange defense for his son's crime. His father was no stranger to Dodge City, as he provided from his ranches in Texas a huge percentage of the cattle brought there each year. Mifflin Kennedy was also the co-founder of the King Ranch. Kennedy, Texas is named for him, as is Kennedy County. So he arrived, they say, with a satchel full of money and arranged for his 23-year-old son, Spike, to get the medical care he needed for his shoulder wound. After a meeting that included Marshall Masterson, Mayor Kelly, the crime's supposed target, deputies, and the judge, they came to an understanding. Spike would be released for lack of evidence. No one saw him do it. Some say there was a good deal of money exchanged that day because in the year following, each of those attending suddenly had eyebrow-raising funds for the building of nice homes and purchasing of successful businesses. Dora, just 34, was not forgotten. She received a magnificent funeral with a grand escort from all levels of society. As many as 400 mounted cowboys escorted her funeral carriage to Boot Hill, the biggest funeral ever seen in Dodge City. Spike, or Santiago, as Mother Petra called him, eventually lost most of his left arm due to infections within the wound. He returned to Texas and died 6 years later at the age of 29 of typhoid fever. He is buried in the family plot in the Brownsville Cemetery. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
W.F. Strong is a Fulbright Scholar and Professor of Culture and Communication at the University of Texas, RGV. You can check out more of his stories from Texas at texasstandard.org and wherever fine podcasts are served.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. President Donald Trump, in an interview, said that only 6% of COVID deaths were actually caused by the coronavirus. The rest were from, quote, other reasons. Is that a fact? Joining us now, Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Where did President Trump actually make this claim?
So this was one of several statements we saw President Trump make last week, trying to argue that COVID-19 is not as deadly as it seems, or even as deadly as his own public health agencies have been reporting. First, we saw him retweet a since-deleted post that made allegations that the CDC was quietly updating its numbers to show a smaller number of deaths than was previously reported, which PolitiFact has debunked. That's false. But then he made this statement during an interview on Fox News with Laura Ingraham, and I believe we have audio.
Yes, let's take a listen.
And by the way, I saw a statistic come out the other day talking about only 6% of the people actually died from COVID, which is a very interest, that they died from
well,
other
they had
reasons.
Comorbidities.
Okay, that they died from other reasons, that 6% of the people actually died from COVID. That's a pretty specific figure, 6%. Where does he seem to be getting that from?
So we can actually trace that number back to a weekly report that's produced by the National Center for Health Statistics, which is part of the CDC. And every Wednesday, they release new death counts for the coronavirus based on death certificates. And in that report, there's a line that states, and I'm quoting here, for 6% of the deaths, COVID-19 was the only cause mentioned. For deaths with conditions or causes in addition to COVID-19, on average, there were 2.6 additional conditions or causes per death. And this statement has caused quite a bit of confusion when we're talking about COVID-19 deaths, because if you just look at part of it, it can leave you with a really different impression here. And it's the same source of the claim that Trump retweeted last week about the CDC adjusting the death counts. But it's clearly being misconstrued here.
You know, you're right. This does sound quite confusing indeed, because one of the messages that public health officials have been stressing is that people who have pre-existing conditions are far more vulnerable than others when it comes to succumbing to the coronavirus, that in fact, this affects respiratory conditions, people who are older and dealing with pre-existing diseases and that sort of thing. But people actually dying from COVID-19 itself. Do I hear what you're saying, that the data itself has made this distinction or draws this distinction and has said that just 6% of people at one point died from the coronavirus alone?
You're exactly right. And that's why they're looking at the data this way and separating out cases where the only cause of death listed is COVID-19, as opposed to these other causes, which are called comorbidities. And you kind of heard it in the audio there. Laura Ingraham kind of jumped in and pushed back at Trump's claim about this 6% and said, you're talking about comorbidities here. Because when a patient is admitted to the hospital dealing with the coronavirus, the virus is listed on their medical record, but as the day progresses, as the weeks progress, they could develop other conditions like respiratory failure, they could experience cardiac arrest, or any other number of conditions. And all of those would be listed on that patient's death certificate, even though COVID-19 started the entire process. So that's what we're talking about here when we're talking about comorbidities. They're conditions patient patient's experience in tandem with a primary condition. In this case, it's COVID-19. So the idea that only 6% of the more than 188,000 COVID-19 deaths that we have reported right now by the CDC are actually caused by COVID-19 is just wrong.
So I think it, well, it sounds like you are ready for a ruling, am I right?
I'm ready if you are.
All right, well, hit us with it.
This claim from President Trump is just flat out ridiculous. We rate it pants on fire.
Pants on fire. That's the rating from PolitiFact on Donald Trump's claim that only 6% of COVID deaths were actually from COVID. Madeline Meckelberg joins us each week from PolitiFact, Texas. Madeline, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening
to the Texas Standard.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar joins us once again. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. Continuing to hear from the fine folks out there about our interview with U.S. Senator John Cornyn, Chris Timberlake chimes in via Twitter, and he says that we need to push back against John Cornyn's assertion that, quote, nobody saw this coming, end quote, when it comes to the pandemic. Chris writes, yes, many people saw this coming. Unfortunately, the Trump administration dismantled some of the expert infrastructure that would have helped them deal with it. Obviously, that response to the coronavirus, something that we're all living with and has upended our lives in myriad ways. One of those ways, of course, is education. And as I noted earlier, we are hearing from parents and caregivers out there about what it's been like. As we know, this week has been sort of the defining, like, I guess, back to school week. Now that Labor Day is through, a bunch of big ISDs like Austin and Houston have re-entered the school semester. So here's what Rosemary Laguna says via our Facebook page. She's in an interesting situation. She writes that she dislikes that the teachers at her children's school have to juggle in-person teaching with online teaching because her daughter is in person and she was left waiting for teachers to finish troubleshooting online problems. She adds that she knows it isn't the teacher's fault. It's just not a good plan to ask them to do both. And I would say that many people being asked to do both, both teachers, parents, and caregivers out there. And the somewhat humorous comment here that I like from Michelle Barlow Dickens. She's impressed with how good her child has gotten at Zoom. She says that during Zoom meetings, she's always griping about how other kids are talking nonsense and making the meetings longer. I think she's training for middle management. And I got to say, you know, a joke doesn't really land the same way on Zoom when you're, you know, trying to time with, you know, 12 other people on there. So interesting. Yeah. So, yeah. Good to see. Good to see our next generation of business leaders coming up that way. And it does, you know, raise the question of how long will we have to conduct our, you know, education and our business this way? And, you know, that is a very open-ended question indeed right now, David.
I think that business will definitely change. And it's something that a lot of people have been noticing and commenting on, that back to work, when it eventually comes, may not look anything like what back to work used to look like. You know, something that, we have not quite touched on yet, but there's seems to be a lot of angst about what's going to happen in about 2 months here. I was reading in the New York Times today, and I'm sure you've seen a lot of this expressed online as well, Wells. Election day nightmares. What happens if we don't know exactly what has happened on election day? A lot of people trying to game this out. A lot of possibilities, a lot of speculation, and a lot of passion online as well. It's one of many stories we continue to watch. And New York Times also covering a somewhat related story as the state of Georgia says it's going to consider prosecuting some 1,000 people it believes might have voted twice in a recent primary. This contributing to the overall atmosphere and climate about of insecurity when it comes to a lot of questions related to the vote. It's one of many stories we continue to track here at the Texas Standard. We'd love to hear what's on your news radar anytime, 24/7. Visit us at texasstandard.org. Till tomorrow, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the crew, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.